Hello, hello. Can you guys hear me? There we go. Hi, my name is Jack Moffitt. You're here at the Getting There Faster with Open Code session. So hopefully I can help you learn about building things with open code or reusing open code to help you get your ideas to the market or to your friends or to whoever you want to show them to as fast as you can. So I'm going to start with a story from my recent experience with my company called Chess Park. We had, it's an online chess service, so you can play chess with people all over the world. We had just launched the beta version of the site, started to get people to sign up. We had Google AdWords bringing people in, and all of a sudden, things started going bad. So people were making chess moves, and it was taking 30 seconds for them to actually go through the system, and this started getting worse and worse and worse, and people started complaining, and we didn't know what to do. So, of course, all of the developers, including myself, spent a lot of time trying to debug this problem. And we were doing profiling, all kinds of debugging, looking through crash logs, looking through the system logs, pretty much anything we could find to do it. And we spent weeks tracking this thing down. And we went through all the lines of code together. We had code review sessions. We had all kinds of stuff, and we couldn't find this bug. And finally, we tracked it down in a third-party library that we had used called Twisted. And what had happened was there was a little loop in this library that leaked just a tiny amount of memory, and after running for several hours, it was doing a sort or something. And so after the thing got big enough, the sorts were taking so long, it was just bogging everything down. And this, I mean, we were practically in tears over how bad this bug was, and to find out it wasn't even in our own code was sort of disheartening. But this is one of the things that you run into when you use open code, and the thing that I want to try to get across is even though we spent weeks looking for this bug and it wasn't even in our own code, the using the Twisted library for us was a net win by just a large margin. If we hadn't have been looking for their bug, we would have been looking for hundreds of our own bugs in something that we had written ourselves. So once we fixed the bug, we worked with the Twisted team to get the bug fix integrated into the main code base so that everyone else who uses the same library doesn't run into the same problems we did. And of course, there's various hoops that different projects have to get your code changes integrated upstream. Twisted is actually an example of one of the more hard projects to work with. But we did it, and now everyone has the fixed code, and it's working great. So one thing I figure I should answer right off the bat is what do I mean by open code? I mean, there's open source, there's free software, and these are and public domain, and these are sort of all what I'm talking about. Whether you're a particular fan of the GPL license or the BSD license, or you hate copyright altogether and want everything to be in the public domain, these sort of non-restrictive licenses, what I refer to as open code. And I want to try to get across that using open code and reusing this code, and if you can't, building your own open code and releasing that will help you and others get where they're trying to go faster, get the applications you want built faster, and you don't have to spend a lot of time designing infrastructure pieces or libraries or this kind of thing. This is an age-old thing. I mean, it was really popularized debate when C++ came out. Everyone was like, object reuse is going to make everyone way more productive. So it's just another iteration of that kind of paradigm. Building on open code, as my story hopefully illustrates, has a lot of pros and cons. A lot of people only talk about how great it is to use open source, and they don't mention that, you know, every once in a while you run into a bug that no one actually knows how to fix, that you have to deal with it yourself. And sometimes, you know, you're not going to be able to find code out there that does what you want. Maybe your idea doesn't exist and you have to write your own, or maybe your idea does exist, but none of the alternatives meet the requirements that you have, whether for memory use or performance or scalability or any of those kinds of things. And so when you roll your own, of course, my opinion is that you should probably release it as open code. And it's pretty easy to do if you do a couple of things, and I'll go over those when we get there. So first of all, why is the open important? Why is this freeness important? And there's a lot of reasons for that. One is that you get access to a large community of developers, of users, of testers, documentation writers, translators. All of these people become available to you because there's such a low barrier to participation in an open or free project. I mean, essentially, you just go to the web page, you download it, You maybe try it out, you use it. If you find a bug, maybe you tell them, maybe you don't. It doesn't matter. And so for users, this is so, and developers, it's so liberating to be able to do this that, you know, even the smallest projects will have probably hundreds of people looking at them, even if just in passing. And you never know when one of those passing people is going to find the bug that you've been tracking or give you a suggestion that, you know, turns the project around or something of that nature. You're also doing a lot to increase the public knowledge base and increasing sort of the tool base that everyone else has to work with. I don't know where the internet would be today if we didn't have the people behind Apache and MySQL and Linux and these kinds of projects. They've built an infrastructure on which so much stuff is built now that it's hard to imagine what it would look like had everything stayed proprietary or been some other solution. It also helps you incubate and nurture new ideas, including your own new ideas. So in addition to, you know, I may write some library that does some very specific small purpose for me, it may be the foundations of somebody else's new project. And also, if I take someone else's small library, I may be able to get my new ideas and my new project out really quickly. And you can see examples of this happening all the time with frameworks like Rails. People are, you know, downloading Rails, watching a 15-minute movie, and building wikis and blogs and all kinds of things that they can imagine. And these free and open source projects are really critical in this kind of incubation stuff. I mean, without the free flow of ideas, you really can't do anything. I mean, all science is built on a similar concept, and then software is getting to be that way as well. And there's so many new companies and new projects. I mean, just at South by Southwest, you probably, I'd venture a guess that probably 50% or more of the companies are using Rails or PHP or Linux or Apache, MySQL, one of these open technologies they've used to build the foundations of their project. So using open code is a good idea. Like, whenever I start a project, first I go look for, is there anything similar? Are there any of these pieces that are similar that I can go out and just plug in and try to use? And of course, certain pieces are now standard. Linux, Apache, these projects pretty much everyone has heard of. Almost all projects are built on top of these frameworks, at least a good portion of them are. And they've become sort of standard pieces, just like the web is a standard piece or HTTP is a standard piece. Now when people are deploying applications, they just, okay, we're going to do it on Linux and MySQL or some combination of these other open projects. There's a lot of up-and-coming frameworks and libraries you can use. There's Rails. Python has Django. There's the Twisted project, which we use at Chess Park, which is a Python-based, really in-depth networking library. There's JavaScript has a lot of these things coming up, Scriptaculous, all the other JavaScript libs, like, why can't I think of any of the names of them right now? But I'm sure you guys have heard of several of them. The Yahoo JavaScript library, for instance. Yahoo is a good example of a company who not only uses open source and open code to their advantage by running servers. I mean, they were an early adopter of Perl and Linux and things like this. And, now they're putting their own open source projects into the marketplace, like their JavaScript library, the Yahoo widgets. They also have, I don't know if any of you have used their Firefox extension YSlow, which tells you why your website might be slow and what you can do to optimize it. That's actually a really good tool if you haven't heard of it. So when you're using Linux, Apache, and these standard sorts of things, your part of the deal is really minimal. I mean, you download it, you use it, it just works. These are all very mature projects. Your interaction with the communities around them is probably going to be minimal. I mean, I don't know how many of these people using Linux now actually have conversations with the kernel developers anymore. And the same is true for MySQL and Apache. Usually you don't run into bugs in these software unless you're doing something really weird. And you don't really have to do much. So you get something for basically nothing. With the frameworks and stuff, since they're not as mature, there start to be some cons for working with them. For instance, you may find bugs. I know we found several bugs in Scriptaculous, in Twisted, in Django. Pretty much anything we've used, we found some small bug in. So you have to deal with these bugs either by waiting for the community to come up with a fix, to fix it yourself. You might find a project that almost fits but needs some extra help. So you have to do your own extension work. We did several of these things with, again, the Twisted Library. The biggest example from our own projects is there's a set of protocols for doing instant messaging called XMPP, which you may have heard of. Google Talk is built on top of this framework, and it's starting to spread a little wider now. But these protocols contain the basic ideas for, you know, instant messaging presence that everyone's used to from AOL Instant Messenger and Yahoo Messenger. But for us, since we were doing gaming, they didn't really do everything we needed to do. We needed to be able to set up games, to have games linked to chat rooms, to be able to pass information between people in various arbitrary ways. And so we developed extensions to these protocols it was much easier to sort of extend the protocols to do what we wanted than to come up with our own whole instant messaging and presence protocol and then build chess on top of that as well. A lot of the problem was already solved for us. So with the libraries, a lot of times your extensions are going to be bug fixes are going to be performance problems, some function doesn't work the way it's supposed to. And usually the community is pretty good about fixing those kinds of things, but you do have to jump in there and help sometimes. So in some ways, it may not be a good idea to use a bunch of open code if you don't have anyone in house that can actually understand a little bit of it, because sometimes you do have to get in there and read the source and such. Now there's a question, you always run into this problem where you can't find what you need, or you need to extend it, or what you want doesn't exist, or the best thing out there really just isn't good enough. And you have to decide whether you're going to build something new for yourself, or you're going to reuse some of this other code that somebody else has written. And of course, I hope that if you ever come to this decision and you do decide to build it, that you would decide to build it and release it as open code. But deciding whether to do this is a really core decision, and I think every project faces a number of these. So the first thing to know is, you have to look for alternatives, find out if they're suitable, if they're even available. And if you can't find any, then you have to go through this list of pros and cons. Why should I build it? Why should I keep looking for an alternative? Things that you get when you build your own, is you're going to get exactly the solution that you want, because of course you're building it to your specifications. You're going to be able to perhaps capitalize on your solution. Perhaps there's a business model where you can integrate this new code that you have written, either through licensing or through any kind of creative business model that you might be able to come up with. You're also going to have a little better QA because your own team is going to be QAing it. Plus, if you release it as open code, you're going to get the QA from the community. But there's also a lot of reasons not to do it. The main one being it's a distraction from the thing that you're doing. If you're trying to really get a product to market and there's a piece that's missing, you may not want to have to deal with building that piece yourself. It may suit you better to just pay some money and try to get something that works, or to just make one of the things that almost works work the way you want it to. And no one can really help you with that except for yourself. A lot of people think that they don't want to do open code because they think it might help their competitors, which I think is a little, it's not really a very good reason, because just because a solution is part of any particular library that you make, or a piece of code, or a piece of a project that you make, just because it solves the problem that you're set out to do doesn't mean your competitors did it the same way. And also, releasing what you make is open and free doesn't necessarily mean that you're releasing everything you do open and free. It may just be a small piece. Like, for instance, I don't think Yahoo is worried about Google getting a hold of YSlow. And Amazon is not really worried about eBay using the Amazon Web Services to, speed up their infrastructure. And the other thing that you have to look out for is if you do build your own thing, you have to manage the project. You have to communicate with your users. You have to communicate with the people using stuff. You have to have a website for people to download it from. You have to answer bug report emails. If you want to have a successful piece of open code, you sort of have to invest some time into this community process and management. So we've done many projects, or I have done many projects as open. A couple of them is non-open. A few from the last couple of years, for instance, we have a library called Strophe, which is a library, a C-based library for doing communication with this XMPP protocols. So if your program wants to talk to an XMPP server, you need this piece of code to sort of pass in messages, and it formats it into XML and sends it over the wire for you and handles responses and all sort of that. And there's a couple, I mean, there's probably a dozen libraries that do this. Most of them are based in Linux. They don't work in Windows. Some of them don't work in the Mac. So there was a lot of stuff here, and we wanted our code to work on Windows and in Linux. We weren't as concerned with the Mac because mostly stuff that works in Linux works on the Mac nowadays. And so we had this dilemma. And the first thing we did is we went and evaluated all the libraries. We found one called Loudmouth, I believe, and it didn't work very well on Windows. So I spent probably 2 weeks trying to do a port, or maybe it was only 1 week, and I got a port to Windows done. It had some other libraries that, you know, that it depended on that also needed to be ported, and I sent this big patch to the Loudmouth guys, and they weren't interested at all because they didn't care about Windows. And also, there was some technical reasons why it wasn't super great anyway. It was built on all of these dependencies that are sort of in the Linux world and part of the GNOME project that made it sort of hard to transition into Windows. But we did get it working, and it worked fairly well. But they just weren't very interested in it. And that was the main reason we decided to go ahead and do our own project, was because not only did it not quite fit what we wanted, even though I thought we could make it do what we wanted to do, but the team behind the project really wasn't interested in helping us out. And it's really hard to make something work if the community behind the project isn't interested in what you're doing. Because then you have to maintain your own version of the project, and it's almost as much work as running your own project, except that now you're running your own project with someone else's code, which is never fun. So we ended up building our own. And one of the things we did, we made it work perfectly on Windows and on Linux, just like we wanted. It's really simple. It does one thing. It doesn't have a whole lot of these dependencies. So anyone else who comes to the table and says, I want this piece of code, doesn't have to worry about the kind of things we were dealing with, like, oh, I need it ported to Windows CE. So, you know, now I have to worry about all these other things that need to be ported to Win CE. It's just really simple. The other thing we wanted to do is we knew that other people really needed, we found this missing hole in the market of Windows XMPP libraries that were, you know, in C-based. I mean, there were plenty of that were in C-sharp and stuff. And so we decided to do a dual licensing model where we would have a commercial version that you could buy, or you could use the GPL version if you would release your own software. So basically, other free software projects can use it however they want, but if you don't want to show us your code, then you have to pay for it. And we licensed this, I wouldn't say all the time, but I mean, there was a few times a year we get somebody new who comes to the table and wants to buy a license for this piece of code. It costs us almost nothing now to maintain because it's pretty well debugged. We use it all day for our own project, so anytime something comes in, it's easily fixed. And we get a little bit of income from it too, so it made the development time that we invested has already been paid back several times over. We also have another project called Punjab, which is an interface between It's an interface basically between your web browser and the XMPP server, so you can have essentially a two-way connection over a stateless web connection. You have a question? XMPP is the Extensible Messaging and Presence Protocol. It's an IETF standard for instant messaging. Otherwise known as Jabber, sorry. Probably should have mentioned that before. So this Punjab piece is a way to interface the web to Jabber, which is, it's kind of complicated for various technical reasons. But there was a project called Punjab that I looked at for doing this, and it didn't quite work like I wanted, mostly for performance reasons. And so I decided to sort of play around with it, and I wrote a very simplified version of the same program that had the performance characteristics I wanted. And then after talking with the developer of the Punjab project, I integrated my changes into his code as a patch, which he accepted, and now Punjab has all of these changes for everyone. The interesting thing about this story that I didn't even anticipate when it happened was the developer of Punjab now works for me, and he's one of my main developers. After we formed this relationship, I realized that he was working in a lot of the same spaces we were. He knew especially this one project inside and out, and he was really easy to work with from working with him. And so I offered him a job, and he accepted, and now he works on lots of different projects for us. So doing open code and participating in this open code community probably is not going to find you hundreds of new developers, but you're going to get really good ones when you find somebody special out there who's really working with you. And at past companies, the same has been true. I also wrote an internet streaming media server called Icecast years ago. And almost everyone I hired at the company that we use this at, Greenwich Internet Radio, I hired from people who submitted bugs to Icecast or who I'd worked with through the Icecast project. I think we only maybe hired 3 people out of the 15 or 20 people in the company that we hired from, you know, collecting resumes and going through that. Almost everyone we grabbed out of the community who were already interested in what we were doing and working with the code that we had built. We have another project called Palaver, which is basically just a set of group chat extensions for XMPP so that everyone can sit in the, it's like these Meebo chat rooms, essentially. And there was a thing out there that everyone had been using, but it was really old and crusty, and it didn't work very well, and it took a lot of time to set up. And so we just knocked one off in using libraries that other people had built, like Twisted. We were able to get this product done in probably a week, the basic version. And now it's great because we have this chat server that does what we want. It's easy to maintain. Lots of people use it now. And so, for instance, say we find a bug in it, and our developer commits a fix to the bug. Now there's probably, I think, 40 or 50 people who follow the project. Several times they've all found a bug in the fix that we've committed and notified us within 10 minutes of the commit. So we've gotten lots of good QA help for that project that we don't even have to worry about, which is really great because there's lots of XMPP and instant messaging is complicated because so many things are happening and you don't know what order the messages are coming in. So there's lots of edge cases that you can't necessarily foresee. And so it's nice to have all of these other people doing various things with it who, you know, find these weird problems and help us out. So those are just a couple of the projects that we've done and have had a lot of success with doing. So once you get to the point where you decided that you have to build something yourself, there's a bunch of things that you have to sort of consider. And one of the first ones is licensing. So you can choose to do it free. You can do it sort of a dual license commercial model like we did with Strophe. Just to tell you about these other projects, the Strophe we did is a dual license. Punjab is I think under the GPL, and so is Palaver. So a couple of projects we did free, and one project we did is a dual license model. And to be honest, the dual license model takes a bit of extra work because now when anybody wants to email me to license it, I have to go through all of this work to communicate with them. We have to haggle over the price. And depending on how much of that you're doing, you may not want that kind of distraction. This was particularly a problem for us because every time someone wants a license, it happens to be the exact time that we're chasing some mega bug in our code that, you know, we need all the hands on deck for. And dealing with these people who want to, you know, lawyers and going over contracts is not really what I want to be doing with my extra time during those periods. So in the free licensing, you need to choose between, you know, whatever different license you like. There's GPL, there's BSD. If anybody has questions on these licenses or how to dual license, I've been involved with a lot of these things. So hopefully if you have questions, we'll take questions a little later and you can ask me and I'll be happy to explain whatever you guys want on the licensing front. And like I said before, Strophe, we did a dual license. Palaver is free. And of course, we don't make all of our code open source. Our extensions to the protocol are obviously sort of open because anyone can look at the wire and see what we're doing. We make all of the little projects that we do open source, like the Palaver and stuff, because those aren't really our core business. And we're using all of these other little components, just like those that other people have made. We sort of feel it's our duty to give something back. And you know, for instance, and it helps us a lot when, for instance, I have a problem with one of those programs and I email the author or the development team. They're usually very responsive because they know that they're using some of our stuff. And if they have run into a problem, they want to be able to get a hold of me on a quick basis. So we're all sort of working together. once you have made the code, you sort of you have all these requirements, you know, about the release. You have to have a project website. If you want it to be successful anyway, you need a project website. Usually you need some kind of source control. You need mailing lists. You need to be communicative with the other people who are, you know, working with your project. You need to be responsive for bugs. There's all these kind of things that you need to deal with. There's and if you guys need any suggestions on specific tools to use, I can suggest there's a program called Track, which does it has a wiki, a bug tracker. It has an interface for the Subversion, and I think there's plugins for other version control systems and stuff like that. We use that for most of our public projects, and it works really well because it's sort of all in one. A lot of big projects are starting to use it. The Django project uses it. I believe that, what's the other one that I'm thinking of? Of course, the Track project uses it as well. So that's a really good way to start out, especially if you're just doing a first project. I know there's now a lot of sort of Web 2.0 hosted solutions, sort of similar to Google Code. Google Code is also a potential solution for that kind of thing. And a lot of companies have been doing that kind of stuff. And then there's a lot of, there's sort of this long history, especially with the internet, of people doing just amazing things using open code or building their own open code. And I just wanted to go over some of them. I think I mentioned briefly before the Amazon Web Services. This is a company that, you know, was originally about selling books, I guess. And now they sell all kinds of things, and they do all kinds of things. And this Amazon Web Services thing, I think, is really cool. And I should probably mention that we're starting to migrate some of our infrastructure over there. So that's probably why I have such a great buzz about Amazon Web Services. But essentially, they have this cloud computing model where they've released all of this code and essentially all of their infrastructure for anyone to use for pretty much any purpose. So you basically rent time on these virtual machines. And they give you all the tools that you need for Linux to be able to do this. And they provide scalable backup architectures, queuing services, pretty much anything that you need to run a large operation, or if you just need one little tiny machine as a project web server for some company, they have that as well. But they've done all of this and made it available for everyone, and I think this is potentially a huge business model for them, and I guess Wall Street must as well, because their stock is not doing too badly. At least it wasn't until the last couple weeks. So they're going to probably, I mean, imagine, make hordes of money off this if they can keep it working. And all because, you know, they made something that they needed. Of course, they need this huge scalable infrastructure and all of these tools to sell books. And I don't think they're worried about anybody building another Amazon on the system or anything. LiveJournal has sort of a history of doing a bunch of stuff in an open way. Of course, the whole LiveJournal or at least a good part of the code, I think, is an open source project in its own right, so anyone can sort of run their own community service. I don't think there has been too many competitors to LiveJournal using LiveJournals over code. Just to those of you with reservations about doing open projects because you're afraid your competitors will get hold of your ideas can take some of these to heart. They also actually have an XMPP server called DJabberD, so they're using XMPP. 37 Signals, they've been all around the interactive panel, and they've been on several panels. One of the guys there did Ruby on Rails because they needed a way to do projects faster. And they have their backpack service and all these other things that are built on top of this infrastructure that they built for that purpose. And it's doing great. I mean, for one, it's getting them extremely well known because so many people are using Rails and there's books being written about it. And every time they mention 37 Signals. And so these people are getting a lot of press that they otherwise wouldn't get just because they made a little effort to take one of their internal projects and externalize it and give back to the community. Apple does this a lot. I've seen a lot of Apple laptops around here, and those Apple laptops are just full of open code. Most of the operating system is built on open code from, you know, decades ago. They also have things like the Safari web browser is built on WebKit, which was originally an open project. Apple does a lot of work to work with the WebKit team to make WebKit better. For a while, they did it as, this is sort of a way how not to work, in my opinion. They did it as a completely separate project, and then like years later, they sort of decided, hey, let's fold it back into one and work together in a more unified way. They also, they spend a lot of time with the compiler team. So when all the software is compiled on the Macs, they use extensions that Apple developed for GCC that other people have also benefited from. So people who are compiling applications on Linux now are getting the benefits of Apple's research and development into compiler technology. And as I mentioned before, Yahoo, a big user of Perl in the early days and probably numerous other open source projects, is now starting to release a bunch of stuff like YSlow. Google is another example. Although they tend to, because of their rule about employees spending, you know, so much of such and such percentage of their time on other projects, they get a lot of these projects that aren't at all related to Google and that maybe Google doesn't even use. Certainly, they have large infrastructure projects that they keep secret, like the Google base and these kind of things. But they are starting more and more to open things up in an open way. Those were the big examples I can think of. I already told you most of the ones from us. To give you another example from my own history, the Icecast server, I originally wrote my third year in college because the college radio station at SMU had lost its FCC licenses multiple times. The dean or whoever was in charge of the decision-making power decided they weren't going to get another FCC license. And so the only place you could hear the student radio station was in the student union building. And so that was the only place. They had a little DJ booth, and for about 50 feet around the DJ booth, you could hear what the DJ was doing, and that was it. So, and I couldn't get, I was working in the web department at the time, and there was no way to convince the people in charge that to pay for the real server, which was the really only solution at the time, because it was really expensive. So I wrote Icecast to stream MP3s so that this radio station could broadcast and people could listen to it in the dorms. Actually, years later, I finally met with the radio guy again to use Icecast, and they decided not to use it. So did all that work, and in the end, it didn't actually get used for the purpose it was intended for. But I had a great experience with that. I got within months, I had job offers. I actually ended up taking one, getting into internet radio, moved to San Francisco, got involved from that with the ZIFF.org projects, which are patent-free audio and video codecs, which... When we were doing Icecast for commercial radio, we didn't want to have to pay the royalties to use MP3. Most of you probably don't know that that technology is heavily encumbered. It's just not encumbered in a way that affects most people, because Apple or whoever's making your MP3 player is usually picking up the tag and not telling you about it. So we wanted to not have to pay that, so we wanted our own open formats, and we realized that, you know, it would be a lot better and there would be a lot more cool stuff on the internet if you didn't have to worry about what format your music was in or what your video was in. And did that as open code, and you know, I worked with the GoScript team for a while, which actually is a great example of dual licensing at work. They basically made a PostScript and PDF interpreter, sort of similar to Adobe Reader, except in sort of a library version. And it's been a staple of academic use for a long time. It's used in lots of different printers, and. Basically, they did the dual license model. If you wanted to use the GPL version, you had to release your source code, and it was fine and free. And if you wanted to use it in a printer, then you had to pay royalties. And they've had a very successful time making that project into a real commercial business. Of course, now, the dual licensing model was so successful, and they have such a share of the market now, that they were able to undo the dual licensing, and now it's totally free for everyone. You still have to pay if you want to put it in a printer, but they don't have to sort of enforce it with the way they did the dual licensing was they had sort of two versions of the code, and after 6 months, everything in the normal version of the code that was commercial got merged into the GPL one. So there was just a time delay, and now they've taken out the time delay. So you can still get a commercial license, but the people who use it for free don't have to wait for 6 months for the same features. Does anybody have any questions? I think that's about all of the... Sure. You can't enforce anything, obviously, except through the legal system. I mean, what they do is, in order to... for one, the way... It's not really a question of, are these companies like... I don't know, Samsung, going to use the code for free in a printer and make all this money off of us. What happens is this is a really complicated project, and only a couple dozen people really understand these standards well enough and the graphics stuff behind them to do it. And a lot of them work for Adobe. So it's really when there's a bug in this code, like for instance, you have a PDF that has a picture that won't render, they're pretty much the only ones who can fix it. So they're on the support model. They do it as it's a commercial license, but really it's like you're sort of on your own. Although if they caught you doing it for free, they would probably sue you. And it, based on all of these companies who've been using parts of the Linux stack for various tiny operating system things, like in the PlayStation and all of these different devices, the people who are doing that, I forget what the thing is called, but they've been very successful in court going after these companies and settling. So the law seems to be on the side of the open source people, not the people using the code for free. Yeah, the issue with the printers is there's a lot of other proprietary technology involved. They're actually extremely complicated. So for instance, the dithering algorithms, the algorithms that do color management, a lot of these things that you have to license from third parties, and of course they have restrictions on them. So if you wanted to make a printer that was totally open, I don't think they would care. So these companies generally want to keep, the printer companies are pretty uptight about their trade secrets, so. They haven't had a problem doing that. And actually, they've had several cases, and we have also as well, I suspect, of these companies will try out these different solutions, and they'll say, hey, this one works well, and by the time the developer knows it, he's developed half of the app on top of this library, and only then does he go, oh, okay, now we have to license this. So I would say at least 50% of the licensing that we've done for our project Strove has been sort of, I knew we were going to get the license the minute the developer contacted me, because it was clear that they had already invested so much in working with the library that it was just a question of how much are we going to have to pay now. And that, I'm sure that's happened with GoScript too. So, you had a question? I have in other projects. In the projects of Palaver and Punjab, have not, mostly because there's not a whole lot of people that are doing development. They sort of do what they do well enough that mostly we get bug reports, and since we fix them fast enough, no one really cares enough to worry about patching it. Yeah, we get a lot of bug reports, and most of them are simple. We would probably get patches. Oh, like Punjab, before I was involved with the project, of course, I send a patch to it, so there's an example of a patch coming in. But you make a good point, how much work it is. It sort of depends to you. I mean, it's as much work as it takes to make your project successful. For our projects, since they're very small and simple, it doesn't really take that much work. We'll get a bug report. Usually it's a bug that affects us personally or would affect us had we found it already. And so it's in our best interest to fix it immediately. And so we have been doing that. And when you do that, people tend to assume you're always going to do that. And so it mostly becomes a thing about being responsive to communication. For a project that's big, say for instance the Twisted project, which I mentioned earlier, has sort of this gauntlet of things that you have to go through. They have a quite a jumble of code review. And actually maybe a better example is the Django project. We found several problems in Django's use of databases. Basically, it was written assuming that every database was exactly like MySQL, and because of some technical things in the Python language, the way it uses databases is extremely inefficient. So we found these performance problems, we rewrote the database code to fix the performance problems, and then this is sort of coming at it from the other side, but you can from this, you'll be able to see how much work it is for them. So for Django, you submit a bug in their tracker, or they use the track project, which I mentioned before. Usually somebody goes through it and either closes it if it's a stupid bug, like, hey, this doesn't work with new information, they'll set it to needs patch, or, we're not going to work on this right now kind of thing. So for instance, say you get it to, it needs a patch. Say you do a patch and you put it in there and that goes through. Well, then somebody has to review the patch because it's a large project. They have a lot of people with commit access. Various people have authority over different areas. So then the patch goes in, and a lot of times, if you know, especially in the Django project, a couple of the people at the high level, they're very it's very hard to please them. So for instance, maybe they'll reject it because it doesn't have any documentation or no tests or something. And so sometimes you have to do extra work. And all of this is work for them as well. I mean, these guys don't just have my patch to deal with. They're probably dealing with hundreds of these a day. So for a big project, it's a lot of work. I assume that Amazon has an entire staff to do support for the Amazon web stuff. Twisted is a company sort of like us. It's a lot of frameworks that a company has done to do other things. And those guys have sort of a thing where the code, they're sort of difficult in the same way that you have to have a patch, it has to be documented, and it has to have tests that go along with it. So not only do you have to provide a patch, you have to provide the documentation for a patch, and you have to provide tests and ensure that the patch passes those tests. Then they look at it, and then usually it'll go in. So with the Icecast project, there were several people who sent in big patches. And so after I would review a big patch, if it was good and they were continuing to work on stuff, I would give them commit access. A lot of projects have different standards for this. A good example and one that has been written a lot about is the Subversion project. They have a pretty rigorous system, and I'm sure Mozilla does as well, for basically there's a set of people with commit access and they have to vote to give someone else commit access, I believe. And so you have to, so even people who are hired by the company that manages the project have to go through the same process. If you go look on Google Video and search for Subversion, there's a great talk by Ben Collins-Sussman and it's not Carl Fogel, it's the other one. And anyway, one of the other guys about the process that they go through for that. And I highly recommend that talk if you're more interested in hearing about how open source communities are managed. I believe it's called, it's about dealing with bad people. Because of course, all of these people who are submitting patches, there's just as many people telling you suck and trolling and taking up a lot of your time. So you have to watch out for that. And that's actually more work than the good people. So any other questions? Did you have your hand up in the orange? Oh, sorry. Okay, go ahead. It depends on the complexity of what you did, but a lot of times it is a lot of work. And I mentioned before the WebKit example from Apple. They developed Safari in secret, essentially, and one assumes that it took them more than a year. And then all of a sudden, one day, they have Safari, they have all of this work that they did for WebKit. Now, how do you think the WebKit team feels? They were working for a year without any knowledge of any of this happening, and then all of a sudden, someone has basically got this giant fork of their project, and they have no warning. And it's taken them years to get back in sync. I'm sure it took several months to get any code from one to the other, but it's definitely been years. I think it was just announced like less than 6 months ago that they were going to have one unified project. So that's how long has Safari been out? Like 2.5 years or something? So it's 2.5 years for a project of that size. So yeah, I think a couple of weeks for a couple of months worth of patches is probably reasonable. Maybe I haven't stressed it enough, but it's usually well worth it. I mean, I had the horror story in the beginning of the Twisted problem that we couldn't find for weeks. But if we would have wanted to write Twisted ourselves, it would have taken months. And there would have been so many, I mean, in these other projects that we have written, of course, there are bugs. And we know how many bugs there are. I mean, I'm not going to say we're the best developers. We surely think we are. But there's still going to be problems. And so it's a lot of time saved, months of time saved, to be able to use this library, even with a few rough edges, and iron out the rough edges. And of course, the next time I have a project that needs to use Twisted, I know that all of this stuff is fixed. For instance, I've already had several other projects that use Django, and they all use my database patches that were, I've already invested the time in. So. So it happens. We have several companies that do this for Libstrofe, the people that license it. A lot of times we had one company that ported it to Windows CE, and they just sent us a giant tar file and said, here's all the code, and you can use what you want of it. But they didn't give us any explanation, and now we've had to go through and find out stuff. And, of course, it's a lot of work because, their motivation wasn't to have code to give back to us that we could integrate. Their motivation was to ship their product. So a lot of the code is actually wrong. You know, it got the job done that they were trying to do, but it's not really suitable for release. So we've actually, our developer has gone through, you know, it's up to sort of the project maintainers to do what they can with what you gave them. I think Subversion Project also gets a lot of this. I think the GCC project probably is a big person, especially from embedded developers. I mean, you can imagine if somebody comes out with a new chipset, writes GCC extensions, you know, they're worried about now debugging their chipset. They don't care about, you know, other people's use of GCC. So hopefully good, healthy projects usually have some, you know, helpful souls that will try to recover that code. And I'm sure code gets lost. And JBoss is also another example of a company that sort of has a dual licensing model. Are you guys do more support now, or? Okay, so like the opposite of GhostScript, sort of. Yeah, and there's actually a lot of projects that work in that, like the Linux project. Most of the very mature products do that. Apache, I mean, there's branches of Linux that have all kinds of crazy features, and the one that gets released has, you know, been well vetted. Go ahead. My understanding is that basic H.264 is actually patent-free. It's most of the other stuff in the MPEG-4 standard built on top of it that isn't. I'm not sure how correct that is because I haven't looked too much into the licensing of that. Adobe, I don't know. Somebody just sort of submarine bombed us on the latest HTML5 draft with open video codecs. The ZIF, the draft of HTML5 before the last conference had that the recommended codecs were Vorbis and Theora. For audio and video, respectively. And one of the big people in the W3 didn't like it, and so they took the language out of the draft, which is kind of ironic because, you know, the language in the draft sets out specific requirements that a codec would have to fulfill to be included in HTML5, and the only codec that anyone knows that satisfies those requirements are the ZIF.org codecs. Theorem, the Vorbis is quite good. And mature. Theora just went 1.0, I think, recently, or release candidate. It's not quite as mature. It's also probably not quite as ahead of the curve as Vorbis is, because, for one, it's not something that we invented ourselves. We actually, there was a company called Onto, which had a, I think it was called a VP3 originally, the codec, and we did a licensing deal with them where they would basically release all of this intellectual property that had done under a patent-free license and basically gave a patent grant to the community to use for any purpose. And so we basically, we didn't pay any money, but we essentially bought an open video codec for the community. And then we did all of the work to sort of dress it up and make it more modernized and stuff like that, which we're just now finishing probably 5-6 years later. We've had a lot of problems with uptake because most of the people who you need to convince to use the codec, Apple and stuff, have vested interest in those codecs not succeeding. Apple is a patent holder on the MPEG-4 team. Microsoft has several patents in audio, I'm sure. AT&T and Lucent just won suits against Microsoft. So all of these people who are making, you know, the MP3 players, the video players, they're all invested in their own technologies that they're trying to do. And especially on the MPEG committee, there's so many patent holders for these technologies that pretty much everyone is involved. And so they're all sort of in collusion to exclude anyone who's making open stuff. So it's been really hard. We've gotten really great adoption, starting to get that with Theora, especially in games, because games are all about the bottom line. They don't want to pay a whole lot of money. So pretty much all the commercial games now use Aug. I know even Xbox games, I think the Epic put Speaks, which is the voice codec, in their engine and used that. And they actually paid for a lot of development extensions to Speaks because they didn't have the time to do it themselves. But I don't know why uptake on the video is so slow. I think it's mostly because most of the tools people use to create video and most of the players people use to play video don't support that. The one area where we have been making inroads is music creation tools. I believe that Steinberg, Cubase, Ableton Live, I know Mackie's, Traction Studio, Tractor DJ Studio, all of these products support Aug. Pretty much, and I think FLAC, which is one of our lossless codec out of the box. Also, we're now starting to get content providers who are releasing content in open formats, mostly Trent Reznor, the new Nine Inch Nails Ghost album you can get in FLAC, the Saul William albums that Trent Reznor produced you can buy in FLAC. And there's a couple of companies that also offer FLAC downloads. We've had a lot more uptake on the lossless end with the content producers. Which also just now got finished. The BBC codec, they have patents on, and it's not clear what they're going to do with them. Well, in some ways, they're not up to par. One way is that, like I said, H.264 has a lot of stuff layered on top to help, motion compensation, stuff like that, extra stuff. That work probably hasn't been done on the free codecs yet. The free codecs are mostly concerned with the lower level stuff, like H.264 by itself would be. The other thing is the tools aren't there. I mean, it takes a lot of work to make video editing tools, and a lot of tools are tied to some extent to the file format. For instance, most of Apple stuff, you have to work with QuickTime stuff. And so if you want to support H.264 and QuickTime, you have to build H.264 into QuickTime. We had a lot of trouble with this with Vorbis, although I don't know if they had this trouble with Theora. The QuickTime didn't support variable bitrate audio when we did the original Vorbis plugin. So there was no way to integrate our technology into QuickTime until they fixed it later when they had to add support for VBR MP3. So there's several technical hurdles of that nature. Theora is really young. I mean, it just went 1.0 like within the last month or so, I think. So it took us like 5 or 6 years to get it to 1.0, and now we're basically at day zero, and you're asking me how come it hasn't been adopted. I mean, for one thing is it really hasn't been around that long in a format that most companies would consider adopting. And with Vorbis, we're in year 5 or 6 of it being 1.0 and having several maintenance quality upgrades. So the adoption, you can see, is much higher. So one hopes that it's going to be better than Vorbis, because more and more people are starting to see the value of open codecs, and hopefully some of that will help Theora catch on faster than Vorbis did. So, and Vorbis continues to be on the uptake. I don't think we're losing ground. So. Go ahead. Okay, there's a couple different ways. Chess Park, we do it sort of as an alternative income stream with the dual licensing. I already talked about GhostScript. Most projects generally tend to be benevolent, some kind of good benefactor, you know, like Yahoo doing YSlow. This is a product that they just happen to make. They might as well make it open. It doesn't cost them much money. And then the rest of us get to benefit. So I think a lot of projects are sort of funded out of the goodness of these other companies' hearts as offshoots from their R&D budget. you can certainly do it like JBoss does, where they sell support on a very stable version, or like GhostScript does, where there's a specific market in embedded printers that generates them a support revenue stream. This is a question that I wrestle with all the time, because I sort of have devoted most of my energy to writing open code and working with free software projects. And so whenever I start a new project, it's always the first question is, how are we going to pay the bills? I would say that there's not sort of one fundamental model that works. It's a lot of people are still experimenting, and we'll probably see for at least a few more years people experimenting with various models until we find something that works. The one thing we do know is open code is great, and it works well, helps people get stuff done faster. And you can see from the internet, and a lot of the applications on the internet, which are all built on open code, that it's great. It's just a question of, how are we going to figure out how people pay for that? And this is a question that plagues almost every industry right now. The music industry and the video industry, you'll hear here, are also trying to figure out how to monetize their content and the stuff that they produce in a world where stuff is shared very easily. And I think the open source community has the same problem. We haven't solved it yet, how to fund things. But the support model is a popular one. Dual licensing is another one. Benevolence is another one. And there are certainly lots of people in high school and college writing one-off projects to scratch an itch that need no funding. BitTorrent had great luck with the donation model, and then they later formed a company. I remember Brian telling me 2 years ago at South by Southwest some ridiculous number for how much donations they were making, and it floored me. The Jabber project also takes donations. They're not producing code, they produce standards, but it's the same kind of thing. They're sort of co-funded by donations, which they get a lot from corporate sponsors like HP and Intel and things like that. And also the Jabber.com, which is a commercial Jabber server and support company, also helps fund a few people on the project to keep the standards process moving along. Any final questions? Okay, thank you all for coming. If anybody likes to play chess, I have a pair of cards for a 3-month pro memberships at Chess Park, so you can check out some of the open code that we've been writing firsthand. Or if you're just interested in IM networks and gaming, feel free to check it out. I have them up here, so just come up and talk to me, and I'll be probably around outside for several minutes.